Are you ready to cultivate confident, resilient, and mentally strong dancers? Introducing Lauren Ritchie's Mental Skills Masterclasses, designed to build dancers from the inside out. Join them live and online for a transformative journey where each month, dancers will dive deep into a different mental skill, including confidence, growth mindset, motivation, resilience, and stress regulation. In these engaging one-hour sessions, you will learn, reflect, and practice personalized mental skills, exercises, and techniques that you can immediately apply to your training, performances, and everyday life. This program is perfect for dancers age 12 and above who are committed to growth, curiosity, and community. Dancers can log on individually or as dance teams. And don't worry if the live classes don't align with your schedule, as sessions will be recorded and available online for viewing at your convenience. Visit www.withlauren.ca or follow the link below for more details and grab your information package today.
I don't want them to think about the floor at all. I want them to enjoy their dance. You only live once, our job is to support in the background and people be unaware, to the people not to be injured, people to be able to dance for as long and as hard as they like.
Hello and welcome to The Background Dancer. I'm your host, Jason Yup. Thank you for joining me with our community of passionate dance contributors from around the world and across different fields. In this weekly podcast, I offer educational conversations and insightful tips to help you better understand all things offstage about this curious art form. This episode, I explore the technology of dance flooring and the growth of Harlequin floors with Guy Dagger, Harlequin Group CEO and Managing Director at British Harlequin. Hello, Guy. Thank you for coming onto the show and a huge honor to have you on The Background Dancer.
I'm absolutely honored to be joining you guys, actually. Thank you very much for the invite. Great stuff you put out.
I have had a wonderful experience with Harlequin all the way going back to, I think it was 2016, my first time at the International Association for Dance Medicine and Science, IADAMS in short. And that was really my first steps into the dance sciences and the dance health industries. And I remember leaving the conference with these little gifts from Harlequin. I remember at the time I was like, I'm going to get in touch with this company at some point again. And 5 years later, I have you right now, and we're going to talk all things Harlequin. So thank you for coming on. So I can't wait to get started.
I have to say, IADAMS is a great organization, and they've just taken the health of dancers, and they've just taken companies like myself, my own, and pushed us and asked a lot of us, and we've encouraged us to invest in research. And it's had a massively positive influence on dance. I mean, I think one of the elements that always comes through to me is some of the research generated an extra 10 years worth of life for professional dancers if they were using the right floor. And that was the research originally done by Dr. Luke Hopper, actually. So that was all through IADAMS, so good on them.
Let's get things started off with a very essential question for all the listeners. What is Harlequin and why was it first established?
Well, Harlequin actually is a family company. I'm lucky enough to, my father set it up. I mean, he was originally the sales director for a company called Marley. Now, if you dance in the States, you will hear the term Marley used by some of the older generations. And he was the sales director. And one day, David Moggeridge, who at the time was the technical director of the London Festival Ballet. Now we're in ancient history here. London Festival Ballet is the predecessor of what is now English National Ballet. And back in the 70s, David Moggeridge contacted Marley. And we were, at the time were based in Kent, where I'm speaking from now in the southeast of England. And he met my father, and David said, we like your product, but is it possible that you can make it double-sided? At the time, I think it was a nice, good 70s color with a light tan gray, something like this. And so my father managed to convince production to make it, and we started generating the floor, and Festival used it. They recommended it to American Ballet Theatre, the Royal, Paris, and it went on and on. And so and then my father went to the managing director of Marley, I think his name is Broadbent at the time, and said, this is something really amazing. We're doing something crazy, and it's really changing the way that people can dance, because historically people were dancing on, stage cloths, painted stage cloths, and they were like sandpaper. And very inconsistent, and also very expensive on shoes, because it sanded the shoes away. So the manufacturers of the dance shoes at the time were probably not euphoric about them moving over to the double-sided floor, which we now call reversible. Originally, the Marley floor that they called reversible, but they called a harlequin. My father named it. And then Mr. Broadbent said to my father, we're not going to continue with this. It's not the type of volume that we want to do. So my father said, can I buy the plant and manufacture it myself in Kent? And he said, yeah, you're welcome to. So my father got the money together. And because he'd seen the massive impact it was having on choreography, the consistency and everything. So my father, frankly, loves traveling around and seeing the lights of, Misha Baryshnikov and all the rest of it, and seeing them dance. And he was just enthused about it. And he said, this is something great fun. We should be doing this. And that's how the business set up. And now I'm doing it. And my father still is still involved in his 80s. And as soon as we're allowed to travel again, he'll be going back to Pacific Northwest and San Francisco and ABT and watching performances, because it's just part of what we do. So it's good fun. I enjoy this job. It's a good job.
Yeah, speaking of Pacific Northwest, I also know that they just installed new Harlequin floors very recently, if not mistaken. And I saw the images. They were beautiful. Yeah.
I think they're on Harlequin Studio, actually.
Yeah, I think so. Yeah.
Yeah, I look forward to going back there before too long. Oh, when we're allowed to travel to the States again. That'd be wonderful.
Fingers crossed.
Exactly.
Yes.
Exactly.
So speaking of all these different companies, like we have all these different ballet companies, and then also adding on to that, the conservatories, the dance conservatories. And that's when it was a real point of realization for me, when I spent 4 years at the Hong Kong Academy for Performing Arts, only to know that most of our floors were Harlequin floors, right? And we just have had such a privilege dancing on those floors, never really understanding what they've done for us. So what clients are best suited for Harlequin products? And this question is really more about like what Harlequin represents and how it stands out from its competitors.
Yeah, I mean, one thing to bear in mind is Harlequin is, we're talking about dance floors. I mean, we are a flooring company and we do a lot of other areas. So I'm going to limit this whole conversation to dance, but I'm not going to talk about stage building, and I'm not going to talk about, we do a lot of work with television and events and stuff like this. So rock and roll and all these other things. So I thought, because going back to the history of the company, you couldn't survive on dance floors, because it's a relatively niche market around the world. But in terms of what we've really enjoyed and what's taken us and driven our innovation is that dancers have asked a lot of us. I mean, if you go back to, I mean, I'm dropping names like they're going out of fashion here, but Nureyev, he was very much wanted a slightly softer, that if we went away from the Harlequin reversible, the double-sided one, the Germans were particularly keen on, and Hamburg, etc., on having what is that you would have danced on at the APA, which is Harlequin Cascade. But in Paris, they wanted something slightly softer. So we had to have a foam-backed product so that you could get supported point work, which was a more sort of egalitarian product, if you pardon the pun, for the French. and it was, yeah, so, and that's the same. And that was Pacific Northwest, as I mentioned earlier, they adopted the same thing. So it was a bit of a dividing line, and it's sort of like fitting a shoe, really. We have to sort of understand the choreography, how it interacts with other parts of usually an opera house and what people are up to. And then sort of like, as much as you might choose a Capizia or a Fried or a Block or a Gainer Minden or whatever, once you've sort of found the one that you work with, That was the way it works. And it usually divides often down the studio versus cascade line for professional dancers. And so, and then that carries on for years and years. In Australia, there was a competitor and they had a more slippery floor, but most of the choreography, they got used to it and they didn't like a more grippy floor, and so we had a challenge there about how to sort of fit them to a new floor. So when we worked with the oldest company down there, which is West Australian Ballet, we there had to do a combination of various floors to get it just right for them. And then that's been replicated now at Australian Ballet, where Queensland are going to stay mainly on studio. They do have brick cascade. Yeah, it's really horses for courses, and it's what each company needs and what's sort of the DNA of that company, really, as things go on. So it's not an instant answer, that one. Sorry, I should have been more concise.
No, absolutely. So it's all about the differences of, like you said, you know, the companies and how they sort of approach their work, right? And
yes, precisely.
Picking up the phone and go, Harlequin is the best partners for this kind of work. And I'm pretty sure there are a lot of competitors. For example, you've already mentioned that you do not only cater to the dance industry, you cater to other industries as well, the visual arts, the events management, but it's the dance industry that I think Harlequin has had the most impact on. So you have offices in almost everywhere, right? Czech Republic, Luxembourg, US, the UK, Australia, Hong Kong. I'm really interested to know how does different cultural as well as maybe climatic differences influence product design, product delivery?
That's interesting. I mean, if we, this is a question about how we segment dance now, because you've got obviously different types of dance. And I'm going to try and limit this conversation away from ballroom, and I'm going to take it away from flamenco and the percussive dance. And I'm going to keep it very much to classical and modern contemporary, that sort of thing.
Absolutely.
And this is, I think, what we're all here to talk about. I mean, if you're looking specifically towards the Western classical types, then you've got to look towards that history, the continuity, that the choreography, and following all the way through. Things like climatic and stuff like that, it's not overly relevant in the performance space, because there are a lot of environmental guidelines for these performance spaces. I mean, dance spaces are supposed to be between 22 and 26 Celsius, not too much humidity, et cetera, and air exchanges and stuff like this. So on a high-end professional venue, those things are going to be managed out of the equation. Where you have challenges is touring. So if you were to be taking a floor through Saskatchewan in the winter, and you were going to be for various opera houses and performing, then you're going to be taking your floor to possibly minus 20 Celsius, maybe minus 25 Celsius, and up to plus 26 Celsius. It doesn't like cold, but it's formulated to work in the environmental guidelines, you know, that 20 to 30 Celsius air window. And if you go below sort of 5 degrees, then you'll find the floor getting too fast. You've got bigger problems there with the dancers, frankly, not being able to work in those temperatures. Particularly in COVID times, we're getting a lot of challenges of people who wish to perform outside for obvious reasons. And we had to do a job in the only place that doesn't have the pandemic, which is Western Australian Ballet. There they perform outside in a space called the Quarry, and they have one of very few heated floors. What we did is into the panels, the sprung floor, we've integrated the heating element so that when they perform at night under a clear sky, you don't get condensation. When it gets to dew point, you don't get the dew all over the stage. So they heats up the floor to about 26 to 28 Celsius, and so drives the water off the floor. But the problem is all the dancers adore it, because they lie like sort of lizards in the sun, frankly, warming up on the floor, because basically, if we understand what people are up to, then we can make the floor to their requirement. But for performance, it's okay. Where we have to be more careful is underfloor heating when it's getting super hot in some areas in the summer. Places like where the air conditioning may be turned off, like the tropics. Those sorts of places, we have to be a bit careful. And we also got to make sure that the product lasts for, you know, 20 years or so under those conditions. But if we know what people are up to, it's okay. apart from if you get a choreographer, and I will remain nameless about which one, who covers it in 2 tons of sand at the end of the performance. And then it's a bit of a challenge to be sandblasted by the choreography. But you know, we've seen many things over the years.
Yeah, absolutely, sir. And the reason why I asked this question as well is quite recently, because of the pandemic, the HKAPA was very generously donated personal individual practice floors for the students. And I think that was something that was very much appreciated. And I think that's, it has a lot to do with the cultural aspects as well of how we deal with such generosity, what we do with these floors when we have them. Like, what do we do when we go home? Does it make people a little bit more hardworking? Do they find it redundant because we have all these floors already in the companies and such? So that's kind of where my curiosities originated from.
Actually, I wouldn't completely ignore that. There is a really interesting conversation, not to be had with me, but to be had with maybe some of the larger companies, where the home practice viral event, which happened last year, that whole event has driven a huge surge in interest in dance and ballet. And a number of the larger companies had some concerns about audiences in the future. Now they have huge sort of bubble of coming up of people who are interested in the art. And it was a sort of a byproduct of the pandemic that there's so much interest in dance now, and people realize it's a way to connect and express and get rid of stress. And it was a positive outcome from a negative event. So yeah, I would say the home studio mats, whether they go to American Ballet Theatre, oh crikey, I could go on for hours. It was a wonderful event, a wonderful thing. Home performing from home has seeded so much interest in dance and ballet in particular.
Yeah, so yeah, absolutely, great. Sir. Absolutely, it's the TikTok generation right now, and that has really taken exactly. over. But it's great. It's great for the industry. It's great for the art form. I think dance can exist in so many different ways, so many different approaches, be it on a proscenium stage like the English National Ballet or just in a living room.
Yeah.
The commonalities between these two is that Harlequin floors do facilitate that process, that learning, right? So
yeah.
It's really, yeah, a step forward. But I'm really also interested to talk about, I think you already mentioned it a little bit regarding some of the challenges you face. What are some of the real challenges the company has faced maybe in recent times with regards to maybe like market trends and technological advancements maybe? Can you maybe expand a bit on that as well?
I would say at the moment, the biggest challenge is the found space outside. I mean, historically, it's been possible to do everything on the proscenium in that environment, in that controlled environment. Now we need to be outside. We need to engage. We need to be, you know, in the everywhere from the shopping mall to, you know, on the dockside. We need to have, we've got a lot of street dance and hybrids and fusion coming through from there. I mean, obviously, we've got breakdance at the Olympics coming up later on this year. A lot of these fusions are driving. It's quite challenging because what you would need for ballet is not the same as you need for street dance, where you've got shoes or different types of shoes or interfaces. Those things are pushing us quite hard in how we can accommodate different things. The other area is that is the bulk of dance is still done within the education environment. And there's a lot of demand within the education environment for multi-use rooms, something we fight hard against historically because we think what's the crucible of a dance studio and what's generated there is hallowed ground and should be protected. But there's also market forces. So we've had to develop floors which at the switch of a button go from sprung to unsprung. And you literally just switch, do a sort of an iPad on the wall and you just flick it across. And through the wonders of technology, underneath the floor, the whole thing goes from rigid to fully sprung ballet floor. So there's always something interesting going on. And and I mean, you've had ballet at you know, Glastonbury. And so having to deal with that sort of thing is more challenging than most. So yeah, no, there's a lot going on. It's and you're getting so much fusion from various indigenous dances that are influencing, and you get it's so much. It never ends. I mean, it's just lucky. I just feel lucky to be part of it, frankly, to be riding the wave of it, because it's life fulfilling, really.
On top of being a terrific coach and person, Lauren Ritchie's online resources will leave you with more than you can hope for, as you'll find a treasure trove of insightful materials to elevate your dance journey. Explore thought-provoking blogs packed with tips, techniques, and personal insights from Lauren herself, covering everything from mastering mindset to overcoming performance anxiety. Plus, discover hand-picked books and podcast recommendations to expand your knowledge and inspire your growth as a dancer, educator, or leader in the dance community. Dive in today and let her know which was your favorite. I'm speaking with Guy Dagger, Harlequin Group CEO and Managing Director at the British Harlequin Floors. Since the company's inception more than 50 years ago, Harlequin has expanded its products and services beyond the dance industry that include events management and even film and TV. Let's take a short break, and when we come back, we continue our conversation about Harlequin Floors and what it means for dancers in the future. For this week's special shoutouts, we hear from Professor Anis, who is a lecturer and academic based in Malaysia and formerly of University Malaya. And he says, "I have listened to your wonderful podcast and I'm truly amazed at the corpus of materials as well as information being disseminated. You have such energy and inquisitive dialogics, which makes the podcast truly remarkable." Thank you so much, Dr. Anis. Really appreciate that. And for all of you listening, yes, reach out to me and let me know if you have any feedback regarding the range of topics that I intend to explore on this podcast. And yes, hope you've been enjoying it so far. And that's it for this week's special shout out. Among the host of organizations that have partnered with Harlequin Floors include the Hong Kong Ballet, the Metropolitan Opera, the Impulse Dance Vienna International Dance Festival, and CNBC. Now, so this is off script. We talk about the market trends here. Has the pandemic affected the way the company has packaged or designed its products or priced its products, perhaps?
Oh, yeah. Crikey, yeah. I mean, it's absolutely. I mean, if we'd hadn't evolved very, very, very swiftly at the beginning of last year, we would have been in a much more difficult position. I mean, we had to basically get to market very quickly with the home studio proposal. And historically, way we operate is usually long buying cycles with companies. We talk to them for a long time, understand. Then suddenly we're into an Amazon situation where we're having to achieve next day delivery. And with the larger companies, when the dancers were all basically ended up going home, whether it was in Argentina, Brazil, whether or not it was sort of Idaho, or whether or not it was in Tokyo. I mean, that literally happened with the Royal Ballet. I think they were exact examples in the Royal Ballet. We were then having to get those mats to all those people in all those places with the entire world infrastructure crashing around our ears. But it was absolutely imperative the mental health of the dancers was protected, that they got those floors so that they could carry on rehearsing and engaging and trying to hold the companies and the spirit together. So, yeah, we had to do a lot of home studio stuff. The bars was another example of it. The pricing was very different. We had to make it highly competitive. And frankly, there was a large amount of loss involved in doing some of it, but we just had to get on with it. And there was quite a lot of donation went on last year because we're just so keen. It's like seeing, you know, the most beautiful thing collapsing in front of you, and you just had to do whatever you could to shore it up. And I think the team did a cracking job, actually. I have to give huge shout out to everyone who rallied. And also, they didn't know what they were dealing with. And a number of them had to come in and in the middle of COVID and make sure that happened. And we had to have people working crazy odd hours so they weren't with other people. There's manufacturing had all sorts of challenges, but we carried on getting on it. And I have to say, I felt thanks to all the people I'm lucky enough to work with on that one.
It's been a tough situation for one too many companies in the world right now, and the unfortunate ones will sink due to many reasons, and the ones who innovate will survive, I guess. And I'm very happy to hear that.
It was always so, I'm afraid.
Yeah, it's always been, right?
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah. As an iconic feature of dance, how can dancers maybe contribute better towards the growth of the company? Is there a place for dancers to either work for the company in some imaginative capacity, or maybe furthering the brand? Yeah.
Oh yeah. I mean, when you sort of alluded to this question, I was like, this is the wrong way around. Surely it's the job of Harlequin to work for the dancers. You know, but in terms of, working with us, absolutely. I mean, I'm lucky enough, a number of my colleagues are dancers, and one or two of my colleagues have come through the technical side of the dance, particularly from Hong Kong. Notice Mr. Kai Ying Chan, I've noted, who just worked at the ballet. But yes, I mean, we hire, and one of the challenges within ballet is, well known to every dancer, is what you do when you stop being a professional dancer and you transition beyond. Now, not of all of us can be Li Su-Xing and end up with three unbelievably successful careers, you know, from a stockbroker to coming back and being in charge of Queensland Ballet and doing an amazing job down there, setting up the academy and everything. But for others, it is difficult. The transitions in dance, in fact, it's one of those things that we actually, one of our sort of charitable donations in the States, because I do see it, and it is the transition from being a dancer to not being a dancer is a pretty abrupt moment. I would strongly recommend to all dancers that they make sure you keep the skill levels up for those transitions. And one of the areas we would be looking for people who can come in and advise us. We have dancers on the team who have now in the other roles, for instance, product development. There's a lot of people in marketing and areas like that. That's where we would be looking for them, but I'm not sure how many dancers really want to be material scientists, and goodness knows. we hire a weird and wonderful range of people, but obviously we're primarily a manufacturer, so we've got all the sort of skills like CAD/CAM and material science and manufacturing skills, carpentry and stuff like that. But theatre technical is something that always is globally in short supply, and that is useful for advising. And frankly, most dancers are great linguists as well. I mean, dancers are naturally engaging with other people, so they're a highly, highly refined skill set, actually. I would say they're very highly hireable, as long as they manage to keep a couple of irons in the fire, all the way through. And those who do usually prosper very well beyond their professional dancing career. And we hire from that pool of people.
That's what we do here also at the Background Dancer Podcast. My mission is to really introduce all these different forms of post-performance careers, perhaps, for dancers to transition into. I'm not sure whether material scientists can be a realistic one. I'm not sure whether that's a popular pathway to go to, but it's really nice to bring to surface that Harlequin is providing that possibility. And I'm, even just as an advisor, I think, you know, who better to work with than dancers when creating dance floors, right? It just makes complete sense. Precisely. So I'm really, really delighted to hear that. And hopefully all these aspiring Harlequin applicants in the future are listening right now to this episode. But let's talk about the company and what does the company envisage both in the near and distant future?
Oh, crikey. As I mentioned earlier, it's quite a challenging time for the arts in general, and there's a massive shift. I mean, it's sort of from what we knew to the new real, and so most of the stuff that's going on at the moment is more to do with evolving to the new real and understanding what the challenges of the new real are. So it's primarily outdoor performance, and it's primarily smaller numbers because they're manageable, and it's about all that sort of thing. I mean, as the challenge of travel restrictions is so debilitating, particularly for professional companies. You know, you need to go from town to town, city to city, country to country. And those of us who are in Europe, I mean, you barely breathe before you need to get the passport out. Well, if you're British, you have to get your passport out. But it's if you're wise enough to stay in the European Union, then you still cross borders every 2 minutes. And so the challenge for dancers need to tour. And so at the moment, it's a funny old time. Going forward, as I said, there's the fusion of different dance is driving different products for us. One of my bugbears at the moment is younger dancers. Most of the standards, and we are on standards committees, and going back to the great work of iAdams. I mean, it was working with various people at iAdams. They did highlight areas of testing, and we were looking at the impact of landing on dancers. The original standards that were set up for that applied to dance rules were basically based on an American footballer or a basketball player crashing to the floor or wearing thick sneakers. And it was completely unrepresentative of the life of a dancer and the impacts and the injuries that were being caused to dancers because you were applying the wrong model to the whole thing. It was based, I think it's called the Frankfurt or Stuttgart athlete model, which was based on something like an 80 or 90 kilo male. And so this isn't exactly diversity. And they weren't getting any, you know, it wasn't representative of the professionals dancing. Where I'm most interested moving forward, from a technical point of view, and is where we look at younger dancers and where we've got, weights, much lighter weights, how we can ensure we're protecting those growing dancers. I mean, if you take almost any physical activity, let's take something like running or something like that, and if you stress those young bones and those growing, physiques excessively, you end up with injury and long-term injury, you know. And so I'm interested in making sure that we have the right dance floors for a young generation and making sure we can protect them through that whole education period. I mean, there are other areas that, are less interesting to talk about, but I've got children. As I said, we're a family business, and the recycling and ensuring that we have cradle to cradle in our manufacturing is something that I've been banging on about for 10 years ago. And we've, making sure that everybody in the supply chain is, Forestry Stewardship Council, and everyone has the ease to make sure all the products can be recycled at end of life. And I think we have a moral duty to get that right as well. So those sorts of things are sitting, sit on our product development desk every week when we sit down for the meetings. And so, that's where we're at, really.
I believe I can consider myself as a relatively young dancer. So it's wonderful to hear that, being part of hopefully a whole new generation, serving both the dance industry, but also the tech industry, I think, very much hand in hand together.
That's an interesting point, actually, because, I was going back to I was talking to a Russian dancer not long ago, who are probably on the more conservative end of the scale of their approach to the arts and certainly ballet. And they were saying that the evolution in the level of protection offered by the sprung floors has permitted and enabled a greater choreography or greater risks to be taken in the choreography because people can leap higher, land harder, roll, their careers will be longer, et cetera, et cetera. Now, as we're trying to take this art into different media, live streaming and how we do this, cross-technology approaches, it's really interesting. And that, the Instagram approach where, that shared one-off experience is definitely challenging and we're going to have to evolve with it and for it. So it's fun and, gets you up in the morning.
Absolutely. Well, speaking of experience, what do you wish for people to say, firstly, or think after having a Harlequin experience?
I don't want them to think about the floor at all. I want them to enjoy their dance. You only live once, you know, and I think our job is to support in the background and people be unaware, to the people not to be injured, people to be able to dance for as long and as hard as they like. And, you know, we should not be something they're aware of. They should be freed from the sort of the floor, really.
All right. Last question for you, sir. And this is an experimental question that I ask most of my guests. What makes a dancer for you personally?
Oh, that's an impossible question, Jason. what makes a dancer? I think a dancer brings to a situation what wasn't there before, really. And I mean, that's why people go to see it. They want to experience something. You know, it's so ephemeral. It's sort of like butterflies. And it's just like, yeah, I mean, I just love dance simply because it's something I can't do and I recognize the beauty of. And I think we all know that it's absolute perfection is impossible, but it doesn't mean we shouldn't strive for it.
Wow, thank you so much, sir. I think that's pretty much it. Such an honor to have you on the show. Thank you so much. I'm a huge fan, and hopefully, yes, this is only the start.
Oh, it's an honor to be invited along to the background dance. I really appreciated it, Jason. Thank you very much for the invite. And may I wish you a continued success in your career as well and sharing it with others.
Guy Dagger has been my guest today. He is the Harlequin Group Chief Executive Officer and Managing Director at British Harlequin. Check out the show notes for more information regarding Harlequin floors. And go ahead now and find out if you've been dancing on one this whole time already. Do join the conversation and feedback loop on social media, either on Facebook, Instagram, Pinterest, or LinkedIn, depending on where you are, and stand a chance to be featured here on the special shoutouts. Happy listening. Have a great week. Stay healthy. Stay happy. And I'll see you in the next one. Thanks for tuning in to this week's episode. Be sure to subscribe, comment, and leave a review on your designated podcast and social media platforms. If you found this interesting or helpful, feel free to share with members of your community so that they too may connect with us in our quest to foreground dance in the background. I'm Jason Yup of The Background Dancer, and as always, catch you next time. Calling all dance educators and leaders, whether it's through a professional development weekend, day, or workshop, Lauren Ritchie is passionate about connecting with fellow educators who are in the trenches, pouring their hearts into their work with unwavering dedication. From navigating stress and perfectionism to fostering confidence and resilience in dancers, Lauren provides invaluable guidance on supporting students through every step of their journey. Because, let's face it, our work changes lives, and it's most impactful when teachers embrace, communicate, and practice mental skills themselves. Join her online teacher workshops and education sessions, where you explore topics like understanding the brain stages of your students, enhancing motivation, effective feedback strategies, preparing for competition, and fostering team cohesion. Ready to transform your teaching approach and empower your students like never before? Reach out today to learn more at www.withlauren.ca/teacher-workshops or click the link in the show notes below.